What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
Why do Catholics worship Mary?
What's stopping you?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest? Where is purgatory in the Bible?
What's stopping you?
I think the Pope has too much authority.
What's stopping you? You are called to communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Hey, everybody. Welcome again to Called Communion here on EWTN. We're glad you're with us. Today, we're bringing you this program on this network, a Catholic network for non-Catholics. Now, why would we do that? Well, that's because we know that a lot of Catholics listen to EWTN, watch EWTN, check out EWTN.com. And those non-Catholics may have a few questions about the Catholic faith that they're just not seeing answered anywhere else. And maybe they don't know who to turn to. That's why we do this program. Here's our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Outside North America, please dial 1 and then 205-271-2985. You can also text the letters EWTN to 58177. Wait for our response. Once you get it, send us your first name and your brief question. Message and data rates may apply for some folks. Not everybody, some folks. You can also send us an email if you'd rather do that. ctc@ewtn.com is the address. All right, Pedro Quiles, our producer. Vanessa Sanchez handling the phones today. Rich Jesse is on social media. If you'd like to ask a question via YouTube or Facebook, we're streaming on both those platforms. Just put your question in the chat screen, if you would, please. And then we'll get that to the studio here, and we'll take it from there. I'm Tom Price, along with Dr. David Anders.
Tom, how are you today?
I am well. How are you, my friend?
Oh, I'm doing decent. Thank you.
We're going to begin with this question from Wanda, who emailed us this question. Why was it sinful for David to number the people of Israel?
Only because God had told him not to, right? Well, not only, but principally because God told him not to. And God told him not to because God did not want David to assess the strength of his kingdom in terms of the number of troops he could muster, but rather in his loyalty to Yahweh. So that's the rationale.
There you go. Gigi offers this question: who canonized Saint Peter?
For the first millennium of the church, canonizations were a popular sort of ground-up kind of affair. And pretty much all the apostles and characters of the New Testament Christianity were just venerated as saints from the beginning in popular spirituality. And then over time, as some local holy man in some village, reputed for his holiness of life and his asceticism would die and the people would begin to see his prayers and intercessions. And so a local cult would pop up around a saint. And eventually, if the saint were reputed, for miracles or things like that, His fame would grow and spread around the Christian world, and it might catch on and become kind of a universal affair. And that's the way saints would enter into the lectionary, into popular devotion for the first millennium. Well, eventually, we began to have saint inflation. and there were some fairly ridiculous cases of sometimes people were venerating saints that they weren't even sure were historical persons, whether or not they existed or not.
Yikes.
And other times people who, maybe their life wasn't all that after all. And so the church said, we need to bring this in-house, and the Vatican needs to look in and verify, the bishops in the Vatican need to look in and verify that these people actually were holy and had heroic charity, et cetera, and were orthodox in their doctrine and so forth. And so it became a more centralized process. But, like I said, for the first 1,000 years, it didn't function that way.
Well, very good. Gigi, thanks so much for your email. Call to communion here on EWT on our phone line, 833-288-EWTN. If you have a question for Dr. Anders, 833-288-3986. Here's a question from Sandra. Has there ever been a pope from the Eastern Rites of the Church?
So there have been Greek popes.
Okay.
Okay, Greek-speaking popes. But the pope, by definition, is the Bishop of Rome.
Ah.
By definition,
sure.
He's the Bishop of Rome. And so, by definition, the pope is the patriarch of the Latin church.
Okay.
Right? But there have been popes that were ethnically Greek and Greek-speaking.
All right. Well, there you go. Sandra, thanks so much for your email. This one now from Robert. What does it mean for God to be outside of time?
Well, it means that time is a creature. And so, you know, apart from God's creative act, there wouldn't be time.
Mm-hmm.
I am not a good enough philosopher or a physicist to tell you what time is. But I'm comforted in that because neither could St. Augustine tell you what time was. He didn't know what it was, but he's like, we all know when it passes, but we don't know what it is, right? And again, I'm not going to venture into waters that I'm not qualified to speak on, but I think the modern physicists have concluded that time and space are somehow deeply interlocked, and so they both partake of somehow the same physical reality, and I don't know how that cashes out, but again, it's a creature, and so everything that exists, including time and space, are functions of God's creative act, and so God's not subject to them. God is the condition in view of which those things exist. And it means that God, from a practical point of view, it means that God doesn't experience the passage of time, right? Any more than you could hit God with a baseball, right? You throw a baseball as hard as you want in any direction, you're not going to nail God, right? You know, and in the same way, you could speed up time or slow it down or time warp or time jump or time whatever, and you're not going, God is not going to change relative to time,
mm-hmm.
Because time is a creature. It depends on Him, not the other way around. And so basically God doesn't, and it also has other implications. I mean, God doesn't think discursively. You and I think discursively. You know, you think one thing, then you think another, and then you make a connection, then you draw a conclusion, and these things are temporal processes, and God doesn't think that way. God knows everything in a single permanent instant.
Okay. Well, there you go. And thank you so much for your question. Appreciate that, Robert. And finally, from Xenia, how can I best explain baptism of desire?
Great. Well, here, baptism of desire means that God grants the grace of baptism to people who lack the ritual if they die with a desire therefore or thereof.
Okay.
That's what it means.
Okay. Very good. And Xenia, thank you so much for your email and for all the great emails we receive. We try to get to as many as we can on each of our programs. If you would like to send us an email for a future show, here's the address, ctc@ewtn.com, ctc@ewtn.com. Calls are coming in right now from Mary in Illinois. We'll get to her in a moment. And for you, if you have a question for Dr. David Anders, here's that number, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Because it's the Global Catholic Network, I got to give you the outside of North America phone number, 1, and then 205-271-2985. Lots more straight ahead on this edition of Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders. Do stay with us. It's Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders here on EWTN. Our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. If you have a question for David, 833-288-3986. Have you checked out EWTN On Demand? It is a wonderful platform featuring 50 new podcasts every week, as well as an ever-expanding library of audio and video content. For Catholics who want to learn more about their faith, simply using their mobile device, computer, or TV. Your favorite EWTN programs are available 24/7 right there on the EWTN On Demand platform. Visit EWTN.com and then click On Demand. You're going to be good to go. If you're ready now, let's go to the phones at 833-288-EWTN, beginning with Michael in Spokane, Washington, listening on the Great Sacred Heart Radio. Hello, Michael. What's on your mind today, sir?
Well, thank you. And Tom, thank you for calling the Sacred Heart Radio telethon. That was a big boost.
Oh, glad to do that. We love Sacred Heart Radio.
Thank you. Yeah, my question is to Dr. David. Why a person should become a Catholic? I'm talking to someone.
Yeah, thanks. I think a person should become Catholic so that they can receive the grace, the tools, and the information to perfect their person through the grace of God and regain what they lost in Adam, namely to be in the likeness and image of God. Catholicism is a divinely instituted means to an end. And the end is the shaping and the reforming of the human person after the likeness of Christ. In other words, the perfection of our nature according to grace, so that we can attain to a perfect flourishing, ultimately in the beatific vision, but even in this life, the betterment of ourselves and our neighbors and our communities through the perfection of the human person and the life of virtue. And Catholicism was given to us by God, by design, to help effect that process. Now, I think it's important to point out the Catholic Church teaches that it's not like outside of Catholicism, no one gains virtue.
Right.
The Church doesn't teach that, right? It says that there are elements of truth and sanctification in other places as well, and they can, in fact, become a means of sanctification and redemption. But it's in spite of, not because of, the erroneous elements that those other traditions possess. So, you know, I'll give you a concrete example of how that might shake out. There are some non-Catholic Christian denominations, groups, that that say some really good things, have some very good principles about them. You know, they also maybe advocate killing babies.
Ooh.
And you're like, that's not a small thing.
No,
you know?
No.
I've lost weight. My cholesterol's better. You know, my marriage feels pretty decent, and I kill babies for a living. Like, that's a conceivable, and I'm obviously talking about abortionists here.
Yes.
That's a conceivable place a person could be in some non-Catholic Christian denominations, right? Where, you know, I've gotten some good things out of my community, you know, and by the way, they've sanctioned my job of being an abortionist. Well, that's not the kind of human flourishing we're talking about here,
no.
You know? Presbyterians in the antebellum South, who said, I gave up strong drink, and I haven't cheated on my wife, and, you know, neither have my 72 slaves.
Ooh.
You know, well, again, that's not the kind of maybe some good elements in that person's life, but obviously some gross inconsistencies and some profound injustices.
Sure.
And the Catholic faith, the position is, well, you know, no, we're aiming at the perfection of the human person. And that's possible with grace, not without grace, but it is possible with grace. And the model of that perfection is the person of Christ, who gave us the church to shape us into his likeness and image.
Michael, thank you so much for your call today. That opens up a line for you at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Call to Communion here on EWTN. We got a question here from Daniel watching us on YouTube today. I've been trying to figure out what is the road to Damascus, because there's so many different things on it. And what does the Catholic faith say about that?
So the question itself is a bit ambiguous, right? I'm not exactly sure what you're asking. I mean, a lot of times people talk about the road to Damascus, or they talk about, you know, Paul's trip to Damascus when he met Christ.
Yeah.
And that's an historical event in the biography of St. Paul. But then that becomes, for many people, a kind of metaphor for moment of enlightenment in their own spiritual journey. You know,
kind of like crossing the Tiber.
Well, that would be one. People say, well, you know, he had a road to Damascus moment.
I get it. You know, I get it, yeah.
Meaning it becomes a metaphor when you have some kind of key insight or illumination in your own spiritual walk, and you realize some truth, particularly when you realize some truth about yourself that you were once blind to. And I give you an example in my own life. So I've been about the business of being an apologist and a theologian for a very long time, even long before I was Catholic. And I used to do it, you know, pretty eagerly and in the hopes that I could convert people to Christianity or to my brand of Christianity. And it was a feather in my cap. You know, if I could get somebody to pray the sinner's prayer when I was a Protestant, I thought, well, that was pretty neat stuff. And hey, look at me, I'm hot stuff. You know, I'm a good evangelist. And I had some experiences in my life that showed me how hollow that is if I don't actually care about the person I'm evangelizing, that they've stopped being a human being to me and they've just kind of become an object, you know, sort of a kind of like a carnival barker who's trying to get a mark, you know, or, you know, the way a traveling salesman might think of somebody when they knock on their door. You know, they don't care about you as a human being. I'm just trying to make a buck off of you.
And
there's a way to be, believe it or not, to be an evangelist that's kind of exploitive of people that way, that's proselytizing, and it's really about my self-aggrandizement and not their, you know, moral or spiritual improvement. And I had a couple of experiences where one day I woke up and went, oh my gosh, I'm not a good guy. You know, I thought I was such a good guy. And I actually realized that, you know, maybe my motives in all this are not all that pure. And it really kind of took me by surprise,
sure.
You know, kind of. And that's sort of, I mean, that, in a bigger sense, St. Paul, you know, he's running around thinking he's doing the will of God. I mean, he's really persuaded that he's doing the will of God because, yeah, after all, God obviously wants him to kill Christians. And so that's what he's doing. He's chasing them down, he's putting them in prison, and even condoning their execution. And then he meets Jesus on the road to Damascus, and Christ says to him, Paul, Paul, or Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me? And he's like, well, who on earth are you that I should be persecuting you? And he says, you know, when you persecute these other people, you're persecuting me. And Paul goes,
gulp.
Oops. You know,
yeah.
And he saw something. He had an insight. A last example, this is my favorite from Scripture, in 2 Samuel 12. David has just committed adultery. He's committed murder first. He's murdered Uriah the Hittite so he can make Bathsheba available for marriage, and then he marries Bathsheba after having already committed adultery with her. And the prophet Nathan shows up, and he says, hey, David, there's this rich guy with a bunch of sheep, and he's got a neighbor who's poor and has this one sheep. And the guy loves this sheep, and, you know, they go on picnics together, sheep sleeps in his bed, you know, they're best of friends. And the rich neighbor has some visitors that come, and he doesn't want to slaughter his own herd. So he goes and steals the poor guy's sheep and feeds it to his neighbors, to his friends. Now the poor guy's left bereft, and the rich guy's still got his whole herd. And David's incensed, and he says, oh, the man who did this thing, should die. And then Nathan looks at David and says, aha, you, O king, are that man.
Wow.
And then David is cut to the heart and realizes what a bad thing he's done. You might ask yourself the question, well, why didn't Nathan just come in and say, hey, David, you know, adultery and murder are wrong? Well, A, David already knew adultery and murder were wrong. And B, when John the Baptist tried that, it didn't go so well for him. You know?
No.
So instead, what Nathan does is he tells a story that forces David to have an insight, not just a moral lesson, but an actual insight into his character. And it's, again, one of those, you know, toink, oh my gosh, yeah, what have I done kind of moments. And a lot of times that's what people mean when they talk about a kind of a road to Damascus experience, when you have one of those, oh, I should have had a V8.
Daniel, thanks for checking in with us on YouTube today. Call to Communion here on EWTN. Our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. We have lines open for you at 833-288-3986. Got a call from Mary in Illinois listening on the Great Covenant Radio. She couldn't stay on the line, but she did leave us her question. Why does God put people in your life and then suddenly take them away?
Yeah, right. Well, I don't know. Honestly, I don't know. Although that has happened to me, and I have made friends and thought, oh, great, I have a new friend. And then all of a sudden, oh, I thought I had a new friend, and now I don't. And yeah, it can be very painful, especially if you suddenly invest a lot of your emotion and commitment into this idea of a relationship, and you lose that. It can be really quite devastating. And, you know, let me draw a distinction here. You can learn something from almost any experience, good or bad. That's different from saying, I know that God did this thing, so I would learn that, right? Because that's more than I know. Right. That's ultimately, it's impossible for me to discern everything about the divine plan. There may be things in God's plan that you'll never come to see. There may be aspects of this. Maybe it has to do with the other person and not you. Right. So you can't ever know that. But what you can do is you can say, OK, what benefit can I derive from this loss, from this disappointment, from this tragedy? How might I grow closer to the Lord? How might I become more like Christ? And one thing that I've learned, and I've learned it more than once, and I keep learning the lesson, because I've had people make commitments to me and break them. People that I was relying on, maybe emotionally or materially or whatever, what have you. Uh-huh. And I know how painful that is. It's made me very sensitive to, Anders, be really careful about what you commit to people. And if you do commit, well, by all means, you better stick to your commitments, because you would hate for somebody else to look at you and say, well, you never believe what Anders did to me, as I have felt of other people. So I'm not saying that's the total reason that happened to you, but if you can derive that kind of insight from it, well, then you can make some good out of it.
Mary, thanks for listening to us on Covenant Radio. Call to Communion here on EWTN. On our last program, we got a question from Drew watching us on YouTube. We couldn't answer it then, so we're going to answer it right now. Dr. Anders, when did once saved, always saved become a Protestant doctrine in some of the lower churches? Thanks, Drew.
Thanks. I like that descriptor of lower churches.
Lower churches.
I think he means low church churches.
I think so.
They're like non-liturgical churches.
Yeah,
okay,
yeah.
So in the Protestant Reformation, it was an article of Calvinism that if God regenerates you by His grace, and that's what we mean when you have sanctifying grace, you've been regenerated, you've been born again, that if you are regenerated, truly regenerated, then you can't get unregenerated, okay? That was Calvin's doctrine.
Okay.
That's not yet the same thing as once saved, always saved, and I'll explain why. All right, so in Calvinism, this became known as the doctrine of the perseverance of the saints. If somebody's really united to God in grace, they will necessarily persevere to the end and be saved. They're not going to fall away from that state. However, Calvinism recognized that a person could think they were in that condition and be wrong. And so the empirical fact of apostasy was recognized by Calvinists. They recognized there are people who give the appearance of faith, who give the appearance of regeneration, and then later fall into manifest gross sin, or they lose the faith altogether. And the Calvinist position on that would be, well, that person was never regenerated to begin with. They had the appearance, but they didn't have the real McCoy. Okay, but since Calvinism initially had a doctrine of regeneration as something that was conveyed in baptism, or at least was closely associated with baptism, you could have a person whose regeneration was in doubt, you know, like a child, for example. You would presume it because they were in the covenant, they'd been baptized part of the community. You know, Aristotle once said, call no man happy until he's dead, because you can't really know the condition of a man's life until you can assess its totality. And you know, that would be kind of the disposition. Like, you know, persevere, stick with it, you know, and you make it to the end of your journey, we'll know that you were regenerate all along. Now, what happened in 18th century Protestantism is, it started in the 17th century, but it really comes to fruition in the 18th century, is this movement to sort of reconfigure the beginning of Christian life away from baptism and towards the moment of personal conversion. And initially, personal conversion was thought of as something, kind of a spontaneous work of God. In fact, Edwards has a treatise almost exactly by that name. It's like the surprising work of God, about the work of revival in Northampton, Massachusetts. And it's something that sort of comes from the outside and you don't anticipate it, but voila, you've been regenerated and you have some profound conversion experience and that sort of thing. But then 100 years later, in the 19th century, you get the Second Great Awakening. You get men like Charles Grandison Finney who think, we don't have to wait around for God to do this thing. We can manufacture it. We can set up the psychological conditions that can coerce a person into making a decision for Christ and for converting themselves. And it's from that movement that you get the push towards things like the sinner's prayer, you know, pray to receive Jesus into your heart. And so the idea becomes, this is 19th century Protestantism, the idea becomes that, hey, if you do this thing, if you pray this prayer, if you make this commitment, then you're saved. Then you're saved. Now, obviously, that sort of commitment is could be very shallow. It could be just driven by emotion, and naturally, a lot of those people maybe are not going to stick around. But if you say, well, they weren't really saved to begin with, well, then that devalues the whole force of the conversionistic movement, right? And they would say, well, what's the point of revivalism after all if it doesn't stick? Why have revivalism? And so then you get another development, which is this radical once saved, always saved, which, unlike original Calvinism, did not want people to, you know, didn't say if you apostatize, you weren't really saved. Now you begin to get serious antinomianism, where people say, well, all you got to do is walk forward and pray the prayer at the altar, and even if you walk back into sin or lose the faith later, you're still quote-unquote saved. So that's a development of a development of a development within Protestantism. And so the form of the thing that you get today, you know, really, I would date to late 19th, early 20th century. And that's not universal among Protestants. Like, still, the Presbyterians, the Reformed Christians would not hold to that form.
Okay. Very good. And Drew, thanks for your question via YouTube. We're probably about the halfway mark here on EWTN's Call to Communion. Still plenty of time for your phone call at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-EWTN. 3986 for Call to Communion here on EWTN. Do stay with us. Glad you're with us for Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders here on EWTN. Still time for your phone call, and if you call right now, we're going to get you on the air at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Those of you watching on TV today, you can participate as well by sending us an email, ctc@ewtn.com. We'll get back to the phones in just a second here. Congratulations to another EWTN radio partner. That would be KDMI, 97.5 FM, serving Canton, Texas. They are celebrating 10 years with us. Congratulations to Ken Mings and everybody there at St. Teresa Catholic Church from your friends here at EWTN. Let's go now to Joseph in Henderson, Nevada. And Joseph is listening to us on YouTube today. Joseph, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom and Dr. Anders. How you guys doing?
Great. Thanks. How about you?
So the reason for my call today is something I'm not really proud of, but I want to get your advice on this. So I'm a regular participator. I participate in my parish. I serve in the music ministry. I like talking about myself, but I'm very talented. But I've had been suffering for the last 10 years with a strong case of mental illness. I know it's going to sound weird to you, but it's been a big stepping stone to me forming relationships and, you know, really living out the Catholic life that I envisioned for myself. And so I've had a few people in my parish, you know, I don't really get along with, that they're bullies. They harass me. And, I ended up acting out, you know, on them. I don't want to get into the details of it. And I got a letter of excommunication from my bishop, and, it says I'm suspended. I want to know what that word excommunication exactly means or entails. And I've heard the word before, but this has been really affecting me because, you know, I've been serving in church for the last 18 years. And, you know, I feel like my mental illness has really prohibited me from, you know, it's a very sad situation. I almost had to keep myself together to make this phone call.
Okay, thanks. I appreciate the question. So, first of all, if you receive a verdict of excommunication from your bishop, there should be conditions for your reconciliation. Like, excommunication is never permanent, right? There's always something you can do to be reconciled to the church. So, whatever that is, I would go do that thing, you know, and come back to church and come back to the grace of the sacraments. But excommunication forbids you from participating in any Catholic rites. I mean, you cannot receive the sacraments in the church, and you're barred from other forms of participation, and, you know, per the terms of the excommunication. And it's meant to be curative, corrective, to motivate a person to change whatever behavior has motivated the bishop to make this judgment. So it's a serious thing.
Yeah.
And the idea is to get somebody to correct their situation. Now, if it's the case that whatever the behavior was that precipitated this degree of excommunication, you believe to have been the result not of a sort of settled rational judgment on your part, but as the result that was precipitated by mental illness, that would definitely be a mitigating factor. I don't know the extent to which it might mitigate the church's penalty, but it would definitely mitigate the extent of your moral culpability, and I would, you know, give yourself a break and give yourself a pass and so forth. And since the details of this case are way beyond me, I have no idea what we're talking about, and my knowledge, you know, of the fine details of the law of excommunication as application is not that of a canonist. My recommendation to you is that that number one, you start with your pastor, and I presume he knows all about these details. But I would you know, snuggle up real close to your pastor. If he thinks that there has been an injustice done towards you, he can advocate for you. And you know, and you can also obtain privately a canon lawyer to represent you, and you could bring that as well into play. I'm not saying you should. That'd really be the pastor's judgment as to whether you benefit from that or not. Mm-hmm. If there's been some sort of injustice towards you, this is all way above my pay grade. But the important point is, do not despair, because this is not, you're not cast out of the kingdom of heaven or anything like that, right? It just means you're temporarily barred from participation until such time as you've been reconciled to the church as per the terms that the bishop has set out. So get near to your pastor and figure out what that is and how to do it. And then finally, you know, when it comes to the question of mental illness, my heart goes out to you. And this is a scourge that many people in our culture suffer from, and it's quite painful, and it's poorly understood by people outside the mental health community. And a lot of times people who have never had any experience with mental illness, when they encounter it in someone else, they're quick to judge and slow to forgive. And in my judgment, that's a very bad approach. So I imagine that you probably have healthcare. You probably have a psychiatrist mm-hmm. who's treating you, maybe a psychologist. If you don't, of course, you should seek one out. But I also think you should probably seek out other forms of support. And I don't know if you're familiar with the National Alliance on Mental Illness. If you don't, there are good support groups there available, both for people who have mental illnesses as well as their family members. And so I would strongly encourage you to find support in that kind of a community. There are some Catholic parishes that have their own homegrown support groups and communities uh-huh. for those that have mental illnesses. And your diocese probably has an Office of Catholic Social Services. It may have a Department of Catholic Family Services that offers counseling services. And so maybe getting a hold of some of the people at Catholic Social Services or Catholic Family Services and inquiring what resources there might be in the mm-hmm. diocese and support groups for people that suffer from mental illness, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So definitely network and educate yourself. Get support, get the psychiatric care first and foremost. Get the psychology, get the therapy first and foremost. But also don't neglect to find those supportive communities as well, where you can know that you're not alone and other people suffer these things as well.
Joseph, is that helpful for you?
Thank you so much, Dr. Anders. I appreciate you guys' help and support. And just pray for me.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much, Joseph. Mental illness, it touches so many families, doesn't it? It seems like just about every family I know has some kind of a touchstone with mental illness.
So, yeah, I think, I don't know about every family, but
Not every family, but an
awful lot. Yeah. And in my judgment, there are people whose families have been touched by mental illness and or drug addiction.
Yeah.
And then there are the few whose families have not. And if you are in the families that have not, you manifestly do not know what you're talking about when you talk to the families that have been touched.
Yeah.
And so listen, don't give good advice. You can't. All right? You can't. And if you are in a family that's been touched by these scourges, you know that of which I speak. You learn a lot.
We'll leave it right there. Joseph, thanks again for your phone call. Glad that is helpful for you today. Call to Communion here on EWTN. Lawrence is in Raleigh, North Carolina, listening on the iHeartRadio app. Hey, Lawrence, what's on your mind today, sir?
Mr. Anders, last week, the question of predestination came up twice. And I need some clarification.
Sure.
Okay, the first takeaway was God does not intend anyone to go to hell. Okay. And then and there are two categories, the elect and the others. And the elect are those whom God foreknows will be saved and therefore gives them the necessary grace. So on the surface, it sounds to me as if he's doing something unnecessary. Like, if they're going to be saved, then I would say to me it sounds as if, seems as if additional grace is not necessary. But anyway, my understanding was perhaps it's not official church teaching and not theologically accurate that we are all equal in God's eyes, given the since we learn from the Gospels that Jesus goes after the one lost sheep and leaving the 99 righteous behind, and there's more rejoicing in heaven over one sinner who repents than over the many righteous who do not need any repentance. So
okay.
If you could please reconcile all these together and make something that more coherent to me, please.
Sure. So first of all, let me say that the text that you cited in favor of the thesis that God does not have favorites, namely that Jesus goes after the one and leaves the 99, I think proves the opposite of what you just said, right? If what you're trying to establish is that God loves everyone equally and doesn't have favorites, then it cannot be the case that there's more rejoicing over the one than over the 99. Now the irony here is that maybe God's terms of evaluation are not the world's terms. You know, in other words, like the world might value the 99 and leave the one.
Yeah.
But still, Jesus is leaving the 99 and going for the one. He may have inverted the order of priority, but yeah. There's still an order of priority there, right? And how many times do we recite in the Psalter when we get to the Psalm in the Mass? You know, God lifts up the poor and humbles the rich. I mean, there's constant affirmations in the liturgy. Mm-hmm. Of God showing favoritism to one group over another. The election of Abraham from all peoples of the world, you know, well, God didn't elect me to be a great nation through whose descendants the whole world would be blessed, but he chose Abraham. Why Abraham? Not me. Abraham, you know, why did he choose Israel as opposed to, say, Babylon or Greece or Rome?
Mm-hmm.
You know, why did he choose the humanity of Christ rather than some other humanity, the humanity of Jesus, I should say, rather than some other humanity with which the second person of the Trinity might be united in the incarnation? I mean, there are particular judgments that God makes throughout sacred history that would seem to privilege one individual or one group over against another. Okay. Now, so I mean, that's just a manifest fact of revelation. Now, what the church says about all this is the following, and at the end of the day, it never quite completes the circle, right? So there remains mystery. Here's what the church says. You cannot be saved without grace. That's true for everybody.
Sure.
God gives sufficient grace to be saved to everybody. It does not take in every case. Why does it take in one case and not another case? Is it because those in whom it takes are just such good people that they know a good thing when they see it and they latch hold of it? No. That the difference between grace being effective in one life and not in another can't simply lie in the will of the one to whom grace is offered, because then our salvation would be more or less initiated by us rather than by God. So even our will to accept grace is a grace.
Mm-hmm.
And if we persevere to the end, that's not attributable to us, but to God. Persevering to the end is something that we cannot do in our own strength. We can petition God for the grace of perseverance. But at the end of the day, if we persevere, it's due to God. Now, but the church says that the grace that God offers to everyone sufficient for their salvation is not in vain. It says that our prayers for perseverance are effective. It says that we must cooperate with grace, and that's real cooperation. It's not just, you know, pretend cooperation, not some automaton, some simulacrum of participation that God works in us that doesn't really involve our agency. No, our agency really does have to be implicated. It is possible to resist grace. These are all doctrines of the Catholic faith. It's possible to resist grace. It's possible to not persevere. And if we do, it's our fault. And if we reject grace, it's our fault. All right. And so there are some elements in there that strike us as paradoxical. I mean, God wants everyone to be saved. It also says that God does not specifically mark out any individual or group for destruction ahead of time, right? That is the Calvinist view, that God specifically determines some group to not save, and that God does not do that. That's also part of the Catholic position. There are some undefined areas in Catholic dogma regarding predestination. One of them is, if grace is effective in A but not in B, can we assign some intelligible reason why it's effective in A versus B? And that question has not been decided. And so there are theologians that think they can find an explanation for that. There are other theologians that say, no, it's inscrutable. The difference is inscrutable. So that's kind of the long and the short of it. Now, you know, what I always, whenever I get into these metaphysical discussions about the nature of divine decision-making and grace, which are thorny and complicated, and quite honestly, the Council of Trent warned, like, don't talk about this stuff too often in front of well, Councilor Trent didn't know anything about radio, but they probably would have said, this is not the stuff you want to talk about on the radio every day, right? They did say, don't talk about it all the time in public venues where people are going to be scandalized, you know? So granted that I have to deal with some of these metaphysical theses, I always like to come back to the example again, what we started with, which was the election of Abraham, of Christ, of Israel, of Judah, and point out that when there is a case of true election, that's clear in Scripture, okay, God chose Abraham, he didn't choose Nebuchadnezzar, right? When you find a case like that, it's never simply for the sake of the person being chosen, right? God doesn't choose Abraham to save Abraham. He chooses Abraham to save the world. He doesn't choose Judea or Israel to save Israel. He chooses Israel to save the world. He doesn't choose Christ to choose Christ. He chooses Jesus to save the world. And by implication, the same thing's true of us. So if you are a person in whom God's predestinating grace is effective, he doesn't do it for your sake alone. He does it so that you can participate in the salvation of the world.
Yes.
And so there's always kind of a universal scope to God's salvific will, and even his act, even the most selective act of predestination is still oriented towards the other, towards the universal scope of redemption.
Lawrence, great phone call today. Thank you so much for checking in from Raleigh, North Carolina. Call to Communion here on EWTN. One of the great programs on EWTN is Women of Grace. What am I talking about? TV? Radio? Two different shows, one fantastic host, Johnette Williams. She pulls it all together for you on radio each and every day, Monday through Friday at 11 a.m. Eastern, right here on EWTN Radio. Let's go now to Carl, a first-time caller from Jefferson City, Missouri, listening on Covenant Radio. Hey there, Carl. What's on your mind today, sir?
Well, I'm a new Catholic. A priest said that what I had to do was say, I am Catholic, and then have confession. And I had confession Friday. I go to the noonday mass because I can get there on the bus. I've got a lot to learn about doing things right. I love the Catholic Church. I love the Church. And I'm blessed by taking the sacrament. And I'd like to know, the person screening the call said, and you probably did too, that getting people in your parish to help you along the way is the right thing to do.
Okay, yeah, thank you. So is your question to me whether or not you should rely on the help of your parish? Is that what you're asking me?
Yes.
Okay, sure. I really appreciate the question. First of all, let me ask you a couple of questions. Number one, congratulations on becoming Catholic.
Yeah.
That's fantastic. Before you were a Catholic, did you practice some other form of Christianity?
Yes.
Okay, so in that form of Christianity, were you baptized in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit?
You betcha.
Okay.
Yes.
In that, when you became Catholic, did the Catholic priest suggest to you that you needed to receive the sacrament of confirmation?
No.
Okay. You're going to need to be confirmed in the Catholic Church. You need to receive the sacrament of confirmation. I'm kind of shocked that the pastor of your Catholic parish did not mention that to you as a necessity. That is, I mean, it's an astonishing oversight, actually, on his part that he didn't mention anything about confirmation. Just out of curiosity, is there any possibility you were confirmed in another Christian denomination?
No. I was baptized, but I don't think they have confirmation in the faith that I was.
Okay.
In.
Even if they did, it would not be valid. But I was curious because I'm trying to get in the mind of the priest here.
Yeah.
You would definitely need to be confirmed. Did the priest at your that received you into the church, did he suggest that you attend any classes of instruction on the Catholic faith? There's a series of courses worldwide called the Rite of Christian Initiation for Adults, RCIA. Sometimes it's called OCIA, Order of Christian Initiation for Adults. Did the priest say anything about that?
No. and there'd be no way for me to get there.
Okay. All right. You have some impediment. All right, I see. I understand. All right. Well, still, you definitely want to explore confirmation, and you definitely want to explore further instruction in the faith. So maybe this is something, I don't know if we, when we get done with this call, Tom, you think we can send him back to the call screener to get him resourced on maybe some online instruction in RCIA type material, so we could get him through a course that would kind of give him the fundamentals that he would get if he went to an RCIA class. So I definitely think it's worth going through the paces and taking some of that instruction and learning the basics of the faith. If you're able to read, I don't know, that may be an impediment for you to reading, but if you're able to read, I would recommend you get a hold of the Catechism of the Catholic Church. It's a really big book. If it's too big for you, then I would recommend you get something like the Compendium of the Catechism of the Catholic Church. That's a much shorter version. Either one of those would be good. Also, here's a really good resource for you. Father John Trigilio has written a book called Catholicism for Dummies.
Yeah, great
now,
book.
You're not a dummy, Carl. We're all dummies, okay? We're all beginners, right? That's how you have to look at this. But it's in that same series that does, you know, like how to work on, you know, Microsoft Excel for Dummies. It's the For Dummies series.
Yeah.
He has a Catholicism for Dummies. And that'd be a great sort of like, you know, jump in with both feet and learn the basics kind of introduction to the Catholic faith for you. So maybe get a hold of Father John Trigilio, Catholicism for Dummies. And he's on the network, too. You'll be able
to
catch.
Is.
Is that on Mondays he's on?
By golly, it is.
Well, so he's on after this show.
Well, that's right.
Yeah, so maybe stick around. And I don't know if he gets to call to an hour, I don't know if we'd let him do that. But if Carl can talk to Father John, too, that might be kind of neat. So what else? And in terms of your basic question, which is, should you ask for help from people in your parish? Absolutely. Absolutely. You said it would be difficult for you to get to a class. If it's possible for you to get to the parish, then definitely join some groups. If it's not possible for you to get to the parish, reach out to the parish about people getting to you. You know, most Catholic parishes have a kind of outreach ministry for the homebound and the sick and so forth. So look into that as well and ask for help. But yeah, what you're doing today is great. You're reaching out and asking for help. Reach out and ask for help. And you're welcome to, you know, call the network. We have a listener comment line, and we have other resources that you can call into the EWTN and speak to people, and they can resource you with things. We can help you. But definitely get a hold of some of that literature.
Yeah.
But critical in all of this is you really do need to look into the sacrament of confirmation. Is the parish where you were received, is that kind of like the only parish for a long ways out? You're kind of out in the boondocks, and there's only one parish near you? Is that your situation?
No, there are three. There are three in Jefferson City.
Okay, there are three. All right. So you might also just like, you don't necessarily have to stick with one parish. You might look around, and if you find a parish where maybe seems like they're a little bit more robust in their reception of new converts, maybe find a way for you to get involved in RCA. Maybe a priest who's maybe more eager to give you the sacrament of confirmation. I'd follow up with that, because again, it's an astonishing oversight that a pastor would receive you into the church and not confirm you in the church. That kind of, don't worry about it. You've done anything wrong. That doesn't mean you don't have a relationship with God or anything like that. And it doesn't bar you from communion. You're fine. But it's the three sacraments of initiation in the Catholic faith: baptism, First Communion, and confirmation. And so we really want to get people through all three of them so they're fully initiated.
Pedro is going to put you on hold, Carl, and we'll get some information from our call screener back to you in just a moment here. A real quick question as we're heading out the door, David. This is from Joe watching us on YouTube. Is the ladder of Jacob's ladder, is that the first mention of angels?
Oh, no. Not by a long shot. So there's dispute about this, but arguably, the sons of God in Genesis 6 are held by some interpreters to be angels, not all.
Okay.
There are the angel of the Lord, and the identity of the angel of the Lord is a bit ambiguous, is mentioned a couple of places in the Genesis before that Jacob business. And angels definitely show up in the episode with with Abraham and the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah.
Oh, yeah.
So there's several angel ophanies in the book of Genesis prior to Jacob's ladder.
Very good. Joe, thanks for watching us on YouTube. We also got a question from Nick, but we don't have time to answer today, so we'll carry that over to our next program. Dr. David Anders, thank you, my friend.
Hey, thank you, Tom.
Thanks to everybody who tuned in, who joined us with your questions. Always appreciate hearing from you. That's why we do this show. Don't forget, we do it Monday through Friday on EWTN Radio at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. Check out the podcast whenever you wish at EWTN.com/podcast. I'm Tom Price, along with Dr. David Anders and our great team here. Thanks for joining us. See you next time on Call to Communion. Have a great day, and God bless.